China and Russia hold their first joint naval drills in the western part of the Pacific Ocean amid tensions with the U.S. A Palestinian human rights organization says Israel's designation of six leading civil society groups as terrorists is aimed at silencing their voices. And Germany's coronavirus infections rise to a level not seen since May, with health officials warning that the situation is likely to worsen as winter approaches. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Russia and China have held a naval exercise in the western part of the Pacific Ocean with warships of the two nations patrolling a vast maritime region. During their first joint patrols, Russian and Chinese vessels have covered over 1,700 nautical miles. They have passed through the Sugara Strait for the first time in the six-day patrols. Now, the waterway in northern Japan is regarded as international waters. It separates Japan's main island and its northern island of Hokkaido. Japan said earlier this week that a group of 10 vessels from Russia and China sailed through the waterway. The Russian Defense Ministry says the drill aims to maintain peace and stability in the Asia-Pacific region and protect the two countries' maritime trade activities. Meanwhile, North Korea has accused the United States of raising military tension with China through its support for Taiwan. Vice Foreign Minister Park Myung says such a, quote, reckless backing, plus the growing U.S. military presence in the region, pose a potential threat to North Korea. Park believes the U.S. is meddling in China's internal affairs with its policy on Taiwan. He has also slammed Washington for providing Taipei with upgraded weapons system and military training. China considers Taiwan as a part of its territory and has vowed to bring it under control by force if necessary. In fresh inflammatory comments, U.S. President Joe Biden has said that Washington is committed to defend Taiwan if it comes under attack from China. Well, the U.S. says it will assist Taiwan if a war breaks out with China. The comment received a condemnation from officials in Beijing. China has warned the U.S. against any escalation of the already high tensions in their bilateral ties. Now, the White House reiterated that President Joe Biden is not signaling a change in U.S. policy toward Taiwan.
The United States and China have in recent months escalated their war of words. This time, China says its sovereignty is at risk, cautioning the U.S. against sending the wrong signals.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the three joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman warned that his country has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including its territorial integrity. Wang also noted that Taipei is an inalienable part of China's territory, and the issue is purely China's internal affair, and that Beijing won't allow any external interference. He was responding to these comments U.S. President Joe Biden made during a CNN town hall Q&A.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment.
What the United States says, if the American president puts in the minds of China, of the Taiwanese independence activists and independence politicians, the idea that Taiwan could, for example, make a declaration of independence, China would act on that. And I don't know what the United States could, or on its own, on the terms of its own terms of China policy since the last 50 years, should do or could do to prevent China from acting on that.
The U.S. has recently deployed a fleet of B-1 bombers and 200 airmen to its notorious base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the first such deployment to the island in 15 years. The base at Diego Garcia has a dark history. The U.S. has used the base to launch airstrikes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's said to have been used as a black site to interrogate and torture victims of the CIA.
Well, the United States and China are at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade and commerce, and the disputed South China Sea. The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has recently announced the formation of a group exclusively focused on China. Well, the new trilateral security pact among Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States has also drawn the ire of China. That begs the question if the West is looking for a war with Beijing.
China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and has warned against any of its independence bids. Tensions escalated recently over Chinese military flights as well as increased U.S. military support for Taiwan. Just 2 weeks ago, U.S. media reported that American forces had been secretly training Taiwanese troops for months. China has sovereignty over the Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all world countries recognize that sovereignty. The U.S., too, recognizes Chinese sovereignty over the island, but has long curtailed Taipei in an attempt to unnerve Beijing. The United States, which backs Taipei's separatist president, also continues to sell weapons to the island in defiance of Beijing and in violation of its own official policy.
What they call a strategic ambiguity in American policy. They like to keep Taiwan as in some kind of de facto independent status, but they have recognized de jure that it's one country and Taiwan is a part of China.
China has also denounced the recently clinched AUKUS pact between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the U.S., under which the trio is expected to make a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. Beijing argues that the pact threatens regional stability and poses nuclear proliferation risks. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing.
Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq has slammed as illegal Israel's designation of six Palestinian civil society and human rights groups as terrorists. The organization says the move is aimed at silencing the targeted rights groups. We're now joined by a correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, for the details. Mona, thanks so much for being with us. Well, tell us exactly what's going on and what's being said.
Is that Israeli affairs is that six Palestinian human rights organizations work in a way or another with the Palestinian Front for the Liberation of Palestine, this left-wing Palestinian faction, and that they use the donations to pay for members of the PFLP. However, as you have said, one of these groups, six Palestinian human rights organizations, there is the Al-Haq, Al-Damir, those documented human rights violations by Tel Aviv. There is also the Union of Palestinian Women's Committee, Bissan Center for Research, and DCI, Defense for Children International, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. These human rights organizations help the Palestinian people. They take cases of the Palestinian people to the International Criminal Court. We interviewed a member of the Al-Haq. He said that every time the organization, Al-Haq specifically, achieved tangible results or come closer to bringing Israeli officials and Israeli soldiers to the ICC to prosecute them, then the Israeli regime takes some punishments against them. This is what's going on now. The very serious thing, the labeling these six organizations as terrorists, it means that Israeli soldiers can break into the headquarters of these organizations. They could damage everything there and the properties of the Palestinian human rights organizations, as well as arrest and prosecute employees working in these groups as well.
Mona, is there any type of legal way that these groups can actually try to get their rights reinstated or at least get off this terrorist list? Or what can be done?
Well, now, these groups are hoping that the international community would interfere and force Israel to reverse its decision. However, there are Israeli laws. If the Israeli regime proved that these organizations have any connection, or they pay salaries of members in the PFLP, or they use the donations that come to these NGO groups to pay salaries for PFLP prisoners, or even have employee affiliated with this left-wing party, then the Israeli law would definitely consider them terrorists, and they can be punished here in the occupied territories. But up to the moment, these groups are denying any connection to any Palestinian group, not the PFLP or any other group. They are saying these are Israeli allegations in order to silence the Palestinian organizations and in order not to continue exposing the Israeli crimes being committed against the people of Palestine.
Okay, thank you so much for being with us, Mona Kandiel, out of Ramallah. I'll continue with other news this hour. The Iranian parliament speaker has called on Muslims worldwide to close ranks to defeat hegemonic plots. Mohammed Baqir Ghalibaf made the request in the closing ceremony of the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. He called for increased awareness and prudence among Muslims in the fight against hegemonic plots. Ghalibaf warned the enemies are seeking to sow discord among Muslims. Iranian official described the issue of Palestine as a unifying factor among Muslim nations. He said the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran led to the creation of political Islam that stood up to the Israeli regime. Ghalibaf said Israel suffered repeated defeats in its wars after the Islamic Revolution. Germany has recorded its highest coronavirus infection rate since May. According to the Robert Koch Institute, Germany's incidence rate has reached 100 cases per 100,000 people during the past 7 days. Now, this figure was previously used as a benchmark for lockdowns. However, the country's health minister says they can deal with the rising cases now because of the high vaccination rates. Over 15,000 new cases were recorded during the past day, a sharp rise from the same time of last week. Also, 86 daily deaths were recorded, raising the fatalities to over 95,000. The country's national state of emergency will end on November the 25th, meaning restrictions will automatically expire then unless extended by parliamentary vote. And in Iran, the downward trend in COVID-19 cases and deaths is continuing amid a mass vaccination campaign. The health ministry confirmed a little over 7,000 new infections, the country's lowest caseload since late June. There were also 124 COVID-related deaths during the past day, a new low, record low since early July. More than 79 million doses of vaccines have been administered nationwide. Nearly 29 million people have been fully vaccinated. Just during the past day, 870,000 people were inoculated. Authorities have, however, warned against ignoring health protocols. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has emphasized preemptive measures to prevent the sixth wave of the pandemic. And now to France itself, where yellow vest protesters are back on the streets across that country again, this time along with other demonstrators rejecting the government's economic and health policies. We were earlier joined by our correspondent, Ramin Mazahiri, who gave us the details about the rallies. Now he says the protests are being held in more than 300 cities in France today over President Macron's decisions.
Last week was the start of what the yellow vests are calling season two, and this would be act two, season two. Last week there was protests in over 300 towns and cities across France. Today it's even bigger because it's not just the yellow vests, but it is the railroad strikes. It is the fourth consecutive month, every Saturday, you have had tens of thousands of people in the street protesting against the coronavirus restrictions. So it's just starting to get more and more serious here in France.
Meanwhile, France's Minister of the Economy has surprisingly admitted that prices will continue to rise until at least 2023. That coincided with a new poll which showed that 90% of the nation is worried about inflation and decreased purchasing power. Ramin Mazahiri brings us more from Paris.
A new poll shows that 3 out of every 4 French people believes that their purchasing power has diminished due to rising inflation, and 90% of the nation is worried about it. The nation's economy minister departed from his Western peers by admitting that inflation will continue to rise until 2023 at the earliest. Combined with unemployment, which was entrenched even before the coronavirus recession, the admission seems to announce the beginning of dreaded stagflation.
La vie est chère et encore plus à Paris.
Life is expensive, especially in Paris. From real estate to basic shopping needs to even the price of a simple lunch, our purchasing power keeps going down.
The government has just announced a cap on household gas prices until the end of 2022. Natural gas has soared to record highs across Europe. They also announced a one-time payment of 100 euros to those who earn less than 2,000 euros per month, which amounts to 60% of the population. However, many say the one-off payment is not nearly enough. The Yellow Vest protests, which initially kicked off 3 years ago due to rising fuel prices, just began what they called Season 2 last weekend. They are promising to continue marching. By a huge margin, purchasing power is the number one issue ahead of France's presidential election next year, just as it has been in all the elections since the great financial crisis began.
It's really fragile right now. The middle class just isn't seeing a fair relationship between their work and the amount they are paid.
Inflation is being reported seemingly worldwide, as the coronavirus lockdowns may have created a monetary monster. Many economists say the only solutions are controls on prices, as well as corporate profits, and higher wages, which have remained stagnant across the West for decades. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Meanwhile, energy prices are skyrocketing in the United States amid a steep supply-demand imbalance now in some parts of the country. Gasoline is being sold for an unprecedented $8 per gallon. The average gas price in Los Angeles has hit $4.50 per gallon, the highest in almost 10 years. Long lines are formed in low-price stations. Now, the cost of natural gas has also nearly doubled during the past 6 months. On Thursday, President Joe Biden said gasoline prices will remain high into 2022. He blamed the predicament on the reluctance of foreign oil producers to increase supplies. The demand for oil has sharply risen in the U.S. as the country is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic. And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
the limelight.
It is time for the United Nations to see realities on the ground and recognize the just demands of the Yemeni people instead of wrongly backing the Aden-based rebels and refusing to call for immediate end of the Saudi-UAE aggression. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, Time for UN to Rectify Its Misconstrued Yemen Policy. Stay tuned for more. The sheer numbers that assembled on the main square of Sana'a and flowed like a roaring sea of human beings in adjoining streets for several kilometers recently to hear the speech of their beloved leader as part of celebrations for the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was yet another proof of the popularity of the legitimate government of Yemen, which has been burdened with an unwanted war by Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the orders of the US and Israeli regime. The massive rally, which reverberated with cries of God's Majesty, Allahu Akbar, and Salawat, or blessings upon Prophet and his progeny, while hearing the speech of the leader of the Ansarullah movement, pledged support for Yemen's independence and territorial integrity by denouncing the crimes of the invaders and their local clients, as well as the U.S. Zionist sedition against Islamic unity. No such public gathering was held in Aden or any southern Yemeni town or city where the people feel they are being held hostage by the Saudis and the Emiratis, who are using them as cannon fodder in their military aggression against their northern compatriots. As a matter of fact, the hearts of the people of Yemen are with Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who, as a descendant of Prophet Muhammad, coupled with his patriotism and iron resolve against the invaders, commands respect. He rightly remarked in his speech that the people of Yemen are waging a holy jihad for the sake of God that will never be compromised in defense of freedom and independence of the nation. He added, "We are religiously obliged to confront the aggression with the firmness until the Saudi siege is lifted and the aggression and occupation ends." Sayyid al-Houthi, while denouncing the Arab regimes which have betrayed their cause by ganging up with the illegal Zionist entity called Israel, made it clear that the people of Yemen are united in their support for the oppressed Palestinian people and the true representatives, the Islamic liberation movements. He said, "The resistance in Yemen also fully backs Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist movement, the Hezbollah, and will never cease efforts for the eventual liberation of Islam's former Qibla, the sacred Al-Aqsa Mosque in Baitul Muqaddas." According to reports, these inspiring words from a popular leader as Yemeni forces close in on oil-rich Ma'reb, where mercenaries of the fugitive from justice Mansour Hadi are on their last leg, have been welcomed by the people of southern Yemen. They feel that as Muslims, they ought to adhere to the path of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and strive towards establishing a united and independent Yemen that is free of the hegemony of the Saudis, who have no right to interfere in their affairs, let alone bomb the towns and cities to kill tens of thousands of people and destroy the infrastructure. It is time for the United Nations to see realities on the ground and recognize the just demands of the Yemeni people instead of wrongly backing the Aden-based rebels and refusing to call for immediate end of the Saudi-UAE aggression.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. You are listening to The Lantern, brought to you by IRIB English Radio. As always, alhamdulillah rabbil alameen for this privilege to be able to spend a few moments with you guys as we try to pick up a few reminders here and there from little anecdotes, ahadith, riwayat, ayat from our holy scriptures in order for them to act as a guiding lantern in our lives, inshallah ta'ala. Thank you again for being with us. When I think of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, a few very specific, very exclusive attributes come to my mind. Justice, valor, courage, kindness, and ibadah. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam was truly the spirit of ibadah, and also what's referred to in Arabic as madlumiyya, being oppressed. I don't think anyone in history was ever more oppressed than Imam Ali alayhi salam, and the oppression he faced was both on a personal level, to have his loved ones abused and harassed the way they were, and also on a wider scale of, you know, his rightful position as the leader, as the successor after the noble prophet, being usurped from him, and so much more. But then when we read about the characteristics and the personalities and the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam, there is such a high, elevated sort of vibe, sort of spirit in his words. There's so much hope. There's so much strength. There's so much optimism. And I would really like for us to focus on that aspect of Imam Ali's personality and, you know, try to figure out what was his secret. Now, obviously, there are a lot of elements at play, but life is hard, and its pains and torments are countless, and we always have to try to figure out a way to endure and survive, and not just survive, but really make something good out of this. Let's listen to a short story regarding how to cope, or the perspective to adopt in regard with the hardships of life. And we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Once a wise man held a seminar to teach people how to get rid of sorrows in their life. Many people gathered to hear the wise man's words. The man entered the room and told a very funny joke to the crowd. The crowd roared in laughter. After a couple of minutes, he told them the same joke and only a few of them smiled. When he told the same joke for the third time, no one laughed anymore. The wise man smiled and said, "You can't laugh at the same joke over and over. So why do you cry over the same problem over and over?"
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Right, so this story, it was very to the point, right? It was precise and accurate. It was like a really concise, in a nutshell, good moral of the story sort of piece. And very true, you know? One of the biggest problems we have, or I personally had for the longest time, is that I would find myself dwelling on the past for too long. And there's a very interesting hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, where His Eminence says, "Do not allow your mind to be occupied with the past, for it will prevent you from your future." So this is what I meant by the spirit of strength and optimism. Imam Ali alayhi salam went through a degree of hardship that no one has ever experienced ever before. Yet he talks about the future. He talks about bettering the society. He talks about justice. He talks about world peace. He talks about solving world hunger. He talks about nature. He talks about justice for all living creatures. I mean, if I had gone through a fraction of what Imam Ali alayhi salam experienced, I would have probably just thrown my hands up and said, "You know what? I'm done with this nonsense. I'm done with all of y'all. Y'all are ungrateful. Y'all don't deserve this. Y'all should just burn in hell. I'm out." But instead of that, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, though he was forced to, you know, take to the shadows for a few years, though he was forced into the margins, though he was sort of like an outcast after the demise of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam because of the pressure that the government had created against him and his lovers and followers, he still acted as that beacon of positive energy and strength and justice and kindness. He was still a compass of all that's good and right and positive in this world for anyone and everyone who needed it till the end of time. I'm not trying to say that our hardships are invalid in any way, but I want us to take this short opportunity to reflect on how we can surpass them and how we can move forward from them and grow through the process of letting go of the things that hurt us, haunt us, traumatize us for our own sake. Sure, some people who cause damage in our lives maybe really don't even deserve our forgiveness. They never apologized, they never felt remorse, they never gave us closure. But I think I deserve to lay down this weight and move on from all this darkness and cloudy, murky, icky, gunky feelings and create some clarification and closure and peace for myself. Dwelling in the past, oftentimes, most of the times, really serves no purpose in the case of helping us build a better future. The past really never has anything new to say. And the only thing we can do with our past is learn our lesson and let go. Through the trauma that happened to us, we can learn that, okay, I can live through this. I can survive basically anything. Certain people, so-and-so person, I should avoid. Certain situations I should not get myself into. Certain things I shouldn't say in order for hell not to break loose. Certain companies I should not keep. Certain thoughts I should not allow in my mind. Certain decisions I should not make. Certain choices I should be more careful about. We pick these things up. We basically sieve through, filter through our past. We selectively choose the things that will serve us in our growth and in building a better future. And then we just dump the rest into the recycle bin of universe. And we leave it in Allah's hands and tell Him that, you know what? So that happened. You deal with it now. You're my God. It's your job. I'm going to move forward, and you're going to give me the strength to do so. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 17th of Rabiul Awwal, the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is in fact a day of double celebration. We also celebrate the birth anniversary of the sixth infallible successor of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Congratulations to all of our listeners throughout the world on this very auspicious occasion.
Reports grow of repeat coronavirus infection as experts warn prevalence among Britain's school pupils puts older people at risk. We have prepared for you an article written by Linda Geddes. The piece is titled, Without COVID-19 Jab, Reinfection May Occur Every 16 Months. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Linda Geddes' article. COVID-19 infections surge in England. People are increasingly reporting catching SARS-CoV-2 for a second or even a third time. New analysis has suggested that unvaccinated individuals should expect to be reinfected with COVID-19 every 16 months on average. With winter approaching, scientists are warning that such reinfections could add to the burden of the National Health Service. Some calling for the vaccination program to be extended to all school children, including two doses for teenagers. Stephen Griffin, Associate Professor of Virology at the University of Leeds, says, if you've got high-level prevalence and frequent exposure to the virus, as you have in schools, you're going to see more and more people getting reinfected despite having been double vaccinated. This time last year, the assumption was that although reinfections could occur, this was relatively uncommon, with only 24 or so recorded worldwide. We now know that natural immunity to SARS-CoV-2 begins to dwindle over time. One Danish study suggested that the under-65s had about 80% protection for at least 6 months, while the over-65s had only 47% protection. The arrival of the Delta variant of the coronavirus has further complicated the situation. Danny Altman, Professor of Immunology at Imperial College, London, says, certainly in the healthcare workers that we've been studying, there are many people who had moderately decent levels of antibodies, who have been, in some cases, previously infected and double-dose vaccinated, who have gone down with symptomatic infections. He added, I think it is far more common than the kinds of numbers we were used to before. Office of National Statistics data published on 6 of October says that among 20,262 Britons who tested positive for COVID-19 between July of 2020 and September of 2021, there were 296 reinfections, defined as a new positive test 120 days or more after an initial first positive test, with an average median time of 203 days between positive tests. However, the reinfection risk appears to have been higher since May of 2021, when Delta variant of the coronavirus took over as the predominant variant. Further data from the United States, where various states have now started tracking and reporting on reinfection rates, supports the idea there is a substantially higher risk of reinfection with the Delta variant of the coronavirus. In Oklahoma, which has a population of about 3.9 million, there were 5,229 reinfections reported during September, equivalent to a reinfection rate of 1,152 per 100,000 of the population, and reinfections have risen 350% since May. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, defines reinfection as a laboratory-confirmed case of COVID-19 occurring 90 days or more after a previously lab-confirmed case. Dr. Nasreen Alwan, Associate Professor in Public Health at the University of Southampton, says, with rising levels of SARS-CoV-2 infections in the United Kingdom, many of us are personally aware of children and adults who got reinfected, sometimes after a relatively short period from their first infection. Dr. Alwan says, we still don't know much about the risk factors for reinfection, but the theoretical assumption that once all the young get it, the pandemic will be over is becoming increasingly unlikely. To help answer this question, Professor Jeffrey Townsend and colleagues at Yale University School of Medicine analyzed known reinfection and immunological data from other coronaviruses, including those that cause SARS, MERS, and common colds. By combining this with antibody and other immunological data from people who had recovered from SARS-CoV-2, they were able to model the risk of COVID-19 reinfection over time. The research published in the Lancet Microbe suggested that reinfections would become increasingly common as immunity waned, particularly when the number of infections was high. Professor Townsend says, if we had no infection controls, no one was masking or social distancing, there were no vaccines. We should expect reinfection on a 3-month to 5-year time scale, meaning that the average person should expect to get COVID every 3 months to 5 years. Although vaccines are suppressing the level of infections, the United Kingdom reported 49,156 COVID cases on Monday, 18th of October, the highest figure since mid-July. Rates are highest among secondary school children, but an estimated 8.1% of this group thought to have had COVID-19 in the week ending 9th of October. Professor Townsend added, "If you allow it to run amok in any age group, then it runs amok in all age groups," adding, "The major implications are that if you haven't been vaccinated, you should get vaccinated, and if you've been infected, you should go ahead and get vaccinated anyway, because that will extend the duration of your protection." Griffin says, "If you don't clamp down on prevalence in school children, you'll get the spread of infection and possibly reinfection, which will then potentially spread to parents whose vaccines may be waning, and more critically to grandparents and clinically vulnerable people." Meanwhile, all children in the United Kingdom over the age of 12 are now eligible for at least one COVID jab, and possibly two, depending on age and other factors such as their health. But the pace of the vaccine rollout has come in for some criticism. According to official figures, jab rates among 12 to 15-year-olds are 3 times lower in England than Scotland, with a rate about 14% for the former and 44% for the latter. This could be important, not least because the latest data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, shows infections have shot up among secondary school children, with an estimated 8.1% of this group in England thought to have had COVID in the week ending 9th of October. However, when it comes to schools, it is also worth noting that a number of interventions have been dropped, including the use of face masks in secondary schools in England. By contrast, the Scottish Government has confirmed pupils should continue to wear face masks in school after October half-term. Professor Andrew Hayward, an epidemiologist at the University College London, speaking in a personal capacity, says, "The rates are highest and increasing most in school children, a group with intense mixing at school, no real mask use, low vaccine coverage, and minimum attempts to prevent transmission." While Professor Andrew Hayward noted this group was very unlikely to develop severe illness, Kao noted infections in young people could spill over to other groups. Kao says, "Vaccination of teenagers is likely to be more important for tracking the rise in infections due to the very high number of teenage cases right now, a very different picture to earlier pandemic waves. In the past, new variants have fueled large surges in COVID cases. The Alpha variant played a key role in rising cases last winter, while the Delta variant led to upticks in the spring. Now it seems a new variant is in play in England. More specifically, it seems this could be an offshoot of the Delta variant, which is dominant in the United Kingdom. According to the latest variant technical briefing from the United Kingdom Health Security Agency, a Delta sublineage newly designated as AY.4.2 is noted to be expanding in England, with the body noting it is being monitored and assessed. The agency added that in the week beginning 27th of September, the last week for which complete sequencing data was available, the AY4.2 accounted for about 6% of sequenced coronavirus cases and is on an increasing trajectory. However, Professor François Balou, the director of the University College London Genetics Institute, says the new variant was unlikely to be behind the recent rise in cases. He says its potential higher transmissibility could at this stage only explain a tiny fraction of additional cases. He added, it's around 10% frequency now, and assuming it may be 10% more transmissible, that would only explain an additional 1% extra infections every 5 or so days.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395 1-800-667-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. Again, we are in the week of unity, the week that has been mentioned by that great saint Imam al-Khomeini رحمة الله عليه, in order to bring the hearts of Muslims throughout the world together, to show one united front against the enemies of Islam, which is one of the main and important factors and aspects of unity. Some people take unity to mean that, oh, I must leave my religion and follow your religion, or you must leave your religion and follow my religion. No, this is not what unity means. Unity was never intended to be this. But unity is one of the main factors and aspects of unity, is to show a united front based upon identical principles within that religion against those who do not care of what strand of that religion you follow. They just want that religion to be completely annihilated. So here we see that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam in this tradition is telling us this. And he speaks about it. And he says that the believers are brothers, that the mu'minun are brothers. And according to a lot of the, for example, the commentators of the Holy Quran, where the verse speaks about the brotherhood of the believers, it is the Muslimin. Everybody who believes in the kalima of La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that person is your brother. And the Holy Prophet is clear that the believers are brothers, and the blood is equal. There is no difference between my blood and the blood of another person who believes in the kalima. We are equal in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that we are Muslim. And this is the important part. And this is one of the important factors that, especially in today's world, where we need to focus on, that the enemies of Islam do not care whether you are Sunni or Shia. When a sister wearing hijab is on the streets and they ask her to remove it, or they forcefully remove it, they don't care if she's Sunni or Shia. All they see is the hijab being the symbol of, you know, of God. Simple. It is the symbol of something that is higher than this humanism that they are promoting. So here the Holy Prophet then says that these brothers, these Muslims who are brothers, who see their blood as being equal, when they are in the face of the enemy, they are united and they are one solid, firm line.